Okay. Good evening, everyone. Hi. Hello. A warm welcome to everyone on this dark and dismal evening. I trust you've come to be enlightened. My name is Kathy English. I'm the vice chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation and the public editor of the Toronto Star. We are delighted to welcome BuzzFeed editor-in-chief Ben Smith here tonight, aka BuzzFeed Ben. In conversation with Jamie Poisson. I had opportunity to hear Ben speak at a conference of public editors in June, and I'm really delighted that he agreed to visit Toronto to share his perspectives, even if it is November. More on Ben and BuzzFeed in a bit, but first, some welcomes and thank yous. Thank you, as always, to our JTalk series sponsor, BMO, and our in-kind sponsor, Cision. Tonight, we also have a very special welcome to the TD Bank Group as our new aspiring journalist sponsor, with a special great big thanks to Paolo Pasquini, CJF Director and Associate Vice President of Corporate and Public Affairs at TD. Paolo, please stand. Thanks to Paolo and to TD's support, we are able to welcome here tonight a very special group, students in our audience from Graffiti, the high school newspaper from North Toronto Collegiate, and Epigram, the high school newspaper of Northern Collegiate. Yay. A few years ago, I too worked on a high school newspaper. We also have students from Ryerson School of Journalism and Centennial College, so all future journalists and communicators. Thank you, TD. Reminder that you can tweet questions using the hashtag CJFJTalk. Now let me introduce our moderator. Jamie Poisson is the host of CBC Daily News, daily podcast Front Burner. In a year, this has become must-listen journalism. Prior to this, Jamie spent 8 years as a reporter at the Toronto Star, focused largely on investigative reporting, winning many, many awards. We're really sorry to have lost her, but she still remains one of my favorite people in journalism. Jamie has won the Governor General's Mission Award with a team for reporting on Toronto Mayor Rob Ford. She's won the Sydney Hillman Award for public service journalism twice. So kids, she's the real thing. I'd like to now turn this over to Jamie, and thank you both.
Okay, thank you so much, Kathy, and thank you all for being here today, particularly these two high school newspapers. These are both excellent newspapers. I hope you guys will ask questions when we open up the floor, but also that you'll stick around afterwards. There's free food, so please stick around. Okay, Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News. Ben wanted me to keep it light on his bio, but you know, essentially, Ben was dubbed editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News in 2012, and he built this newsroom from the ground up, so not an easy feat. You have 200 reporters and editors now. That's give or take.
Yeah.
Yeah, and formerly a political reporter at Politico, and you've worked in a whole bunch of other places in New York. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I'm hoping that we can start here. You know, BuzzFeed News is launched, and you are the editor in chief. You know, how do you come to that job? You know, you're working at Politico at the time. You're running a very successful blog.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I had kind of. Right, there were these, as the high schoolers here may like vaguely remember, there were these things called blogs.
Yes.
That were once the future of journalism.
Yeah. And now
or media, and yeah. Are now this sort of ancient form. I'd come up as like a pretty traditional political reporter, but seen that blogs were a great way to, you know, that you could publish things fast on the internet while the New York Times was waiting to put them in the newspaper, and that there was like obvious, stupid advantages in publishing fast on the internet, which, you know, eventually everybody else caught on to. But as a local reporter in 2004, 2005, briefly got some advantage out of that at Politico. The 2008 election really played out on this, on like a half dozen or dozen big political blogs, Ezra Klein and me and mm-hmm. Andrew Sullivan and others. And the whole thing was to try to get a link from one of these other blogs, which you would often get by like attacking them, and then you would email them and say like, hey, I attacked you, and I linked you really prominently in the attack, and I hope you, when you respond and attack me, you will also link me. this whole kind of weird ecosystem.
The weird subculture.
And then if you were in that world in like 2009, like Election Day 2008, the biggest account on Twitter, which was at Barack Obama, tweeted once, like, hey, please remember to vote. But then by like 2010, you could feel that all the energy and that was around these blogs had just moved to Twitter. That's where all the politicians were, it's where all the journalists were, it's where the argument was happening.
Yeah. And you were like using Twitter to direct people to your blog.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Blog was a place to put stuff that was too long for Twitter.
Yeah.
And around that time, BuzzFeed had started up as a place that was really like a laboratory for experimenting with what people would share on this kind of nascent thing called social media, which back then was Facebook and Twitter and StumbleUpon, if anybody remembers that. And so they were, and a lot of what that was like fun lists.
Yeah, listicles.
Listicles.
Cat videos.
We always just call them lists, but okay.
Really? You don't call them why does everyone else call
I don't
them
know.
Listicles?
It seems like demeaning, but really I don't even know how a listicle is different from a list.
Yeah, I don't know.
But in any case, and when Jonah called me, the founder of BuzzFeed called me up
Jonah
to talk
Peretti.
About getting into news, I really had no idea what he was talking about at first. Like this cat list site did not seem like connected to what I was doing. What I realized was that the way that he was thinking about the world was a world in which people would go to then their desktops and type in facebook.com, twitter.com, and the challenge for a publisher was to get your stuff seen there. Not necessarily for people to type in your buzzfeed.com, torontostar.com. The way I was thinking about Twitter, which was to try to like get scoops and have them go viral on Twitter, was very much the way they were thinking about Facebook, and news was starting to travel that way. And so in a way, like at a very kind of abstract level, that's what we were doing when we kind of stapled this news operation onto this kind of entertainment site.
Right, because was he seeing at that time his content on BuzzFeed taking off on Facebook?
Yeah.
So he
and was also seeing that news was starting to and that they didn't have any.
Okay. And so like tell me about these early days. You're trying to start this up. This is a site known for lists and cat videos. Like how are you building a newsroom? Like you actually get some very excellent reporters, away.
And in the beginning, and I kind of missed this, I was also in charge of the lists and cat videos.
Okay.
I'm not anymore. And it was never, like, really my strongest suit. But that's probably why it was taken away from me at some point. But yeah, we're still really good at that stuff. And I think, honestly, like, American politics is among, and political campaigns are really media stories. Like, campaigns are basically publishers. They're just they're putting out videos and text, and they're competing with you as much as you're covering them. And so, as I had learned at Politico, when you launch a new media organization into this kind of media, totally self-reflective media story, if you do a good job, you get a lot of attention. And in fact, the story becomes a bit about you. And that's what we did with BuzzFeed. And it was a great story, like this cat site that's suddenly in the middle of a presidential campaign. And the candidates were really interested in it. And Obama was interested.
Out, like, real stuff.
And we were breaking news, and we were also doing really silly stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny, it was also a moment when I think people kind of liked the idea. And what I used to say on panels like this, you know, well, what people like, if you look at Facebook, is that the, like, serious stuff and the silly stuff's all mixed up together and, like, and it's not delineated the way it used to be, and people really like that. I think that is no longer true. But that in that moment, that felt was, like, very appealing to people.
Basically, are you trying to say that you've evolved over time? So BuzzFeed News at the beginning, it was all sort of mixed together, and now...
Well, I think we've all evolved. Like, I think we followed our audience. It's not like we evolved. Like, I think it's more like people started to see the downside of this kind of homogenized landscape on Facebook where you couldn't tell what was serious and what wasn't. It turns out that wasn't necessarily great.
And so, like, how are you trying to figure out your identity, like, in those early years and then moving forward? Like, because, I mean, this is a site that also does have fun. Like,
It's like we had it's been the sort of blessing and curse of doing news there has always been both that we have this huge audience that really likes the brand.
Mm-hmm.
Like 70-80% of American millennials go on the site every month. Most of them like it. But also, like, the idea that you would trust it, like, didn't make any sense. Like, do you trust Disney? Like, no, it's an entertainment company. And so the notion of BuzzFeed News seemed, like, sort of ridiculous. I mean, I think my philosophy on is it's not like, it's not a marketing challenge. You actually have to just do the work, break stories.
Right.
Story by story, you persuade people.
And how are you persuading these reporters to come to you? Like, are you, like, giving them a pile of money? Are you pitching them this new vision?
My pitch to reporters was always really, like, if you work for a newspaper, your job is to, like, fill column inches.
Yeah.
And if you're at the New York Times and the Washington Post got a story, your job is to match that story. But if what you're trying to do is break through on social media, you have to do a story that nobody else has. You have to break news. And all of the emphasis is get scoops, exclusives, move the story forward,
right.
Answer the questions that are being asked explicitly or implicitly on the internet, but don't just go and write something somebody else wrote. And like the best reporters, that's all they want to do is break news.
Yeah.
And the people who want to just fill column inches, like, you don't want to hire anyone.
Right, because you don't need to cover the news of the day on a front page, right? Like,
right.
Go get
right.
that.
Right. Initially what I would tell reporters is our front page is twitter.com,
yeah.
And if your story is already on there, we're not going to publish it.
Yeah,
it has to be something new.
Okay, so there's that appeal too. And like, how are you choosing your stories? Like, what kind of stories do you, like, work for you that you want to go after?
I mean, I would say in broad strokes, you know, we try to do, in some sense, we try to, like, tell the news stories, like, you know, whatever they are. I mean, I think one of the big stories that we were way ahead on and have continued to break news on is the story of sort of misinformation on the internet. And Craig Silverman, who's based here in Toronto, is the dominant reporter on this beat. He and Jane Litvinenko is also here. Although none of my staff came to this. I don't know what that says.
I know. I know Craig and Jane are
traveling. They're like, they all have
although
excuses.
Although Elamine.
He like dropped me off and left.
I hope he's watching on Facebook right now.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously, Elamine.
But
I think, you know, we try to tell the news stories, but also like that we have a huge, a lot of emphasis on breaking news.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no, I mean, that's the coin of the realm.
Are you trying to find like a different voice than, you know, the New York Times or the Washington Post? Like,
yeah.
These are also organizations that break a lot
yeah,
of
we
news,
try to
right?
Spe-
like, how are you trying to be different than
I mean, you know, we, again, like, I think we try to, like, speak the native language of the internet to assume a familiarity and sophisticated. In our audience, we assume that people are, like, familiar with and sophisticated about social media. Our stories about Snapchat are not going to be, or TikTok are not going to be primarily, like, explaining to you what TikTok is.
Right. Although, I still do not understand how I know this is so awful, but it's crazy how complicated TikTok.
Should I try to explain? No.
No, we can do it later, but
So there are folks in the audience who can explain
it's
TikTok
sort of
to
like
you.
Vine, it's sort of
please, like...
Please,
like, bookmark, if you can, like, pull up your favorite TikToks now for later.
That would be great. Okay, so I want to talk about some of your biggest highlights, right? Like, let's go through some of them. Like, I would certainly say October 2017, you do this expose of leaked emails, which showed Breitbart, like, and how they solicited news stories from, like, essentially white supremacists. I love this piece. It was so well reported. Like, what else would you say you really...
I mean, you know, I always feel like I just want to talk about, like, our best story, like, this week. But that Breitbart story was... I mean, I do think that in our coverage of sort of misinformation, of particularly, like, the infiltration of the American conservative movement by white supremacists, like, I think that there's so much debate in media, which is totally reasonable, about, like, should you call... like. Can you call people racist in headlines? And my view is like, sure, yes. You know, but I also think that it is that like nobody's changing. Like, that doesn't necessarily have any impact on the thing you're writing about. It's like an important kind of moral debate and interesting discussion of what journalism is. But the thing that like gets somebody fired is when you get their secret emails, or when you find out that Milo's password is a reference to Kristallnacht.
Yeah.
And that is like so much higher impact than the debate over whether the words you use in headlines is the actual reporting that exposes stuff that people didn't know and that shocks them when they found out and that forces people's hand. And I think that's like, that's some of the stuff we're proudest of.
Okay, so take me through some of them. Like, you know, even this week or in the last couple of years, like what you're most proud of, these big stories that BuzzFeed News has brought.
I mean, you know, I do think that, and I think this is partly because, you know, if you're the New York Times or you're the Globe and Mail, you can kind of say, like, trust us, we're the New York Times. And like, okay. But nobody, we certainly 8 years ago and probably still not now, we can't just be like, trust us, we're BuzzFeed. Or at least it's harder. And so I think there's more pressure on us in some ways to like have the receipts.
Yeah.
And we've always been very focused. And it's also kind of an online ethos in like, if we're going to write about documents, we're going to publish the documents.
Yeah.
we're going to very aggressively go after the documents. This great reporter of ours, Jason Leopold, will then sue for the documents, and particularly around the Mueller report, you know, we sued five times for documents around the Mueller reports. And when we filed those lawsuits, people were saying to us, oh, that's like a clever stunt. You guys had this dispute with Robert Mueller, now you're suing. You're never going to get any documents. And then a court ordered the FBI to turn over to us thousands, like 4,000 documents on the first of every month for the next 8 years.
And didn't this just started, right?
Yes, and the first one was Saturday. It's amazing. I mean, it's both, like right now, it's like incredibly fun and exciting. Yeah. I am sort of like looking on to like month 11, where
like,
it's going to be like,
Leopold
all right.
Is really regretting this move now?
No.
Like, is he never going to have another weekend
Jason
free?
Jason just won a lawsuit today against the CIA. Yeah. Like, Jason is like not tired of winning. I mean, it's so great. But no, and these were really like revelatory documents that, you know, I think cast a lot of light on Mueller and on the Mueller report and on the fact that he was, you know, at some level, he was the editor, you know, and like, was he a good editor or a bad editor? Like, he had all this information. He told this story. The story came out in a way that was pretty confusing and then allowed Bob Barr to say, well, here's what the story is. And Mueller then decided, well, I'm not going to interpret. It was a strange set of choices he made. And I think as these documents, as we start to see, like, oh, well, this is like the body of stuff that Mueller was working with that he put this report together with, I think you're going to come to understand how political his choices were.
Okay, let's talk about one for a second. So, you know, BuzzFeed, talking about this idea that maybe you don't have, like, the cachet of the New York Times or the Washington Post, you can't say, like, trust up.
They have hundreds of years to build that.
You know,
ask me in, you know, like, 2119.
And we'll talk later if you think you're still going to be around or who you think is going to still be around then.
Once Peter Thiel perfects the, you know, anti-aging technologies.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so it was reported that, the BuzzFeed reported that Michael Cohen, right, was told to lie to Congress about when negotiations to build the Trump Tower took place.
Right.
And, you know, Mueller had learned about this, and then you published this story based on two sources.
Let me actually restate it because it's pretty complicated.
I just want to make sure I'm doing it justice.
I'm intensely familiar with this, so let me exactly phrase it. We reported that Cohen had told Mueller's team that Trump had instructed him to, had directed, the word we used was directed.
Right.
Had directed him to lie. And Mueller then issued this kind of vague statement saying the story wasn't true, which normally when a politician issues a vague statement saying a story isn't true and then refuses to clarify, it's obviously bullshit. Like, that's just, that happens every day.
Well, yeah, although
in
he's
this
not a
case,
politician,
because Robert
so,
Mueller
yeah.
was, in that particular moment, viewed by the American left as, like, this saint, hero, crusader who would save us all from Donald
Trump. Before he testifies, yeah.
Right. Like, the American, all our colleagues in the media were just like, when will you retract this story based on the vague word of a prosecutor?
Yeah.
Which, and I think, you know, that was kind of disgraceful, honestly.
Do you think, it was pretty universal condemnation. Like, that's
yes,
where I was
like,
sitting.
Yes, everybody was like, we were shocked
Trump.
That you could contradict Robert Mueller and then continue to. You know, and there's, it is also ultimately true that the decision about, like, as a matter of law, whether Trump would be charged with obstruction of justice is obviously Robert Mueller's. And at some level, like, whatever he says is the truth about that, because it was his decision. That said, it was already pretty obvious, I think, that our reporting was accurate before the Saturday's dump. But when we got, you know, the Michael Cohen's testimony to Mueller's team, he does say in there stuff about Trump directing him to lie. I think you can then say Michael Cohen is a convicted perjurer, is not a reliable witness. Mm-hmm. If you're Robert Mueller, it's perfectly reasonable not to, like, bring a case against the President of the United States based on his word.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what he said, clearly.
Yeah. So do you feel like these memos that were dumped this weekend are sort of vindicating you?
Totally. Yeah, we look forward to that every month for the next 8 years.
Cool. Do you feel like people are paying attention? Like, are other news outlets picking it up? Are they,
is
the New York Times now saying, well, maybe BuzzFeed was...
No, nobody ever admits they were wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the Washington Post's, you know, Justice Department Bureau is just so faithfully carried Mueller's water. We'll go to their graves with that position.
Do you feel like you get enough credit for the work that you're doing from these, like, bigger, more established players?
Yeah, I think we broadly do. I mean, I think there's, like, a sort of a man bites dog story still sometimes, like, BuzzFeed broke this story that gets a certain amount of credit.
Yeah, they're, like, surprised?
Yeah. Early on, it was great. Like, we always enjoy the jokes.
do you think, like, how is that relationship between you and, like, the New York Times? Like, I mean, I will say,
I mean, mostly,
like,
they've been, like, hiring our people.
So this is what I was just going to ask you
about. So much
enjoy. It seems to me like a lot of them keep going to the New York Times.
Yeah, early on, it was like we were hiring their people sometimes, and people were like, oh, maybe the internet is the future. But, like, Trump, in a way, I think, in the media space, like, partly because he's, you know, when you're the president of the United States, among other things, you're kind of the media consumer in chief.
Yeah.
And your tastes really matter a lot. And he is a guy who reads the New York Post, the New York Times, watches television, you know, like, doesn't, if you told him, like, could you find Breitbart, much less BuzzFeed, and gave him, like, a computer, he wouldn't know how. And so, like, it really, I think, has, and that's, for a number of reasons, that being one of them, also just, like, a sort of sense that in this chaos you want to go to trusted institutions. It's been an incredible time for the New York Times, and has certainly allowed them, I mean, both their business and just the work they've been doing, and, yeah, they've poached a bunch of our people.
What do you think
I can't. I can't talk about the people who turned down their generous offers, unfortunately. But there's some of those too.
What do you think it is that you're doing that is attracting the New York Times, like that makes the New York Times want to poach your reporters? Because I mean, we talked earlier. We kind of blew through it, like how when BuzzFeed News launched, it was a real mix, right, of listicles and cat videos and. But it does seem to me like
we're still doing like a lot of lists and quizzes and like great shopping content.
But your front page today.
But we break a lot of really. But we've split the news and entertainment brands much more clearly. But no, I mean honestly, we're doing big original stories, and I do think that when you're a small news organization, you really have to think about where you can compete, where you can play to win, and then that's the only place you should play. And I think we certainly on the beats, you know, tech and kind of social media and misinformation. Yeah. Investigations and politics. You know, the New York Times reporters and editors just know that we're there competing with them every day. And so that's why they then go and try to hire our reporters.
Do you think, too, like, it's also the voice or, like, a little bit more fun? Like,
yeah, I think we speak in a kind of frank, native internet way and aren't kind of constrained by the woodenness of traditional newspaper conventions, although I would say, like,
and this
you know,
is something like maybe because I mean I see also in the New York Times now, like they're kind of messing around.
Yeah, I would say not. I mean, the Times and the Post both have, I mean, are these huge institutions where, you know, there's still a bunch of guys with flip phones at this factory in Queens who put out a newspaper every day for the New York Times. It's like I went on a school tour.
Flip phones.
I went. My kid had My kid had a like a class tour of the New York Times printing plant, and I was like, oh, I'll chaperone that one. I mean, it's amazing. They operate a giant factory with robots. And so I think, like, it's harder. It's not like a ship that you just kind of turn. But obviously, they and the Post, there are times when they'll do, like, very creative, strange headlines where I'm, like, I feel like, whoa, that's really weird. Like, that's too internet-y for me. You know, like, but at the same time, there are other parts of the paper that still have very much the rhythm of a newspaper. And if you're competing with them, you can take advantage of that.
Speaking of these controversies, you know, we just talked about the Cohen one. I would really like to talk to you about the Trump dossier, which you published in full in 2016. So this is like this report written by Christopher Steele. He's like this intelligence agent, operative? Is that a fair word? It contained all sorts of allegations against Donald Trump that Russia was trying to influence the election, which, you know, at that time was pretty sensational, but also these crazy allegations that Donald Trump was with prostitutes. This is like the P-tape allegation that some people might have heard about it. And so you published it in full. And I would love to talk to you about this today because, you know, I've like thought about this and I thought about it when it came out and I thought about it since. And I think probably if I was you, I wouldn't have published it, but it's like a loosely held opinion I have because I feel sort of paternalistic even saying that. But I'd really like to hear like why you made that decision.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of like uncorroborated stuff in there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, let's see, it's complicated. I think if I was the CBC, maybe I wouldn't have published it.
Yeah.
But to go back, it was right. It was actually really a series of reports of kind of, they felt like he had been the head of the Russia desk at Emma at the British Foreign Intelligence Agency, and they read like intelligence reports and were, you know, clearly not corroborated. And that had been circulating, that consulting, this has all been kind of reported now, but a consulting for this consulting firm that was first working for these Republicans and then working for the Democrats had given to a bunch of reporters and on the condition that they not be identified and that report itself not be used. And people from the Times and the Guardian, I think, and other places have been trying to run down various details, either kind of stand up or knock down details of it. We got it a little late, and we got it through a side door in a way, and so we weren't constrained about publishing it, not publishing it, referring to it in the way that, that kind of these other publications were. But also our first impulse when we got it was, like, these are really interesting tips. Like, we all, as a reporter, is getting in their inbox all sorts of crazy stuff, and you know, you try to run it down, and that's what we were doing. Although I think it was also clear that the document itself had gained really wide currency in Washington. Like, you know, journalists and intelligence officials and members of the Senate and the House, Obama administration officials, like everybody at some point except for the American public had seen this thing.
Right.
And not just seen it, but were like acting based on it. Like if you were in January of 2017 wondering like, God, like John McCain is really keeping his distance from Donald Trump in a way that is a little hard to explain at this point.
But like, if you knew this was the explanation.
And so we were kind of starting to think about what were the conditions under which it would make sense to say, hey, there is this document or to publish it. And then CNN reported that both the president and the president-elect, so Obama and Trump, had been briefed on this document. And I think our view is, you know, whatever the definition is of a document of public interest and like that clearly, that's it. Like being briefed to two presidents of the United States, that's about as high a bar as you get. So we published it.
But why publish the document itself? I mean, okay.
Well, let me give you the
alternative. And not just sort of the story about it.
Right. Let me give you what CNN, this is what CNN did. CNN said, there is this top secret document. It contains allegations that the president is being blackmailed by the Russians. And it's extremely sensational and, you know, shocking. And we're not going to tell you about it. We're not going to show it to you. It would burn your eyes out if you saw it. I mean, honestly, that's unbelievably irresponsible.
So
there are these. I have in my hand a list of suspected members of the Communist Party. I mean, it's like, I think you cannot. I mean, I totally understand the argument for never publishing it, never talking about it, and sort of. I guess when Devin Nunes and Adam Schiff in that spring are waging this pitched battle over that document, you say, hey, we're just not going to explain to you why these guys are mad at each other. I don't know. But the idea that you say there is a secret report with shocking allegations against the President of the United States, and I've seen them, and I feel that I can evaluate them, but you know, you don't look like you can evaluate them.
Okay, and this is why I have like a loosely held opinion, because I do think there is this like paternalistic, you know, thing happening, right? Where we know better. We got you. We're going to protect you. But I think the problem that I have with this is that there is, like, this environment, there is so much stuff flying around. And so by publishing it and publishing what actually turned out to be, like, very real allegations that Russia was meddling.
Right. It was a mix of things that were obviously, in retrospect, I think people... It's so obvious now that people don't realize that this was when he was writing this in the spring of 2016, really shocking that Russia was waging this very comprehensive campaign on Trump's behalf. But on the other hand, things that were apparently not true, Michael Cohen going to Prague.
And, you know, the P tape, certainly nobody has substantiated that. Like, it gave this cover. It felt like it gave this cover. Like, it's all fake news. Just look at this, that this has been published, and now everything is fake. And it's hard to sort of figure out what's true here, so it's all wrong. And
it's
always been hard to figure out what's to like the confusion. And
I mean, it's always been confusing out there, right? Like, I mean, I don't think there wasn't a. I mean, I think among the I don't really see an alternative to sharing that thing with your audience. Yeah. I think, you know, would you rather always have perfect information? Like, certainly. But I think any story unfolds in confusing ways. Every publication in the U.S., I don't really know Canadian law, but, you know, there's the rules in the U.S. is that when something's been entered into court, you can publish it.
Yeah.
And so the newspapers every day are full of unverified facts with the word alleged next to them.
If from a divorce is in, filing, like a statement
of claim from an indictment. I mean, it's totally normal.
You mentioned before, you know, if you were the CBC, maybe you wouldn't have published it. So, like, why are you different than, like, the CBC or... I don't know if you think the New York Times should have published it.
I mean, I basically think that it was the right thing to publish it, and I think most of our peers have come around to that conclusion. I do just think culturally we come from a somewhat different place, and I think I don't think this exactly applies to the dossier, and so it's sort of a cousin of that. And so I kind of want to separate this conversation from that. But I do think that if you're a national broadcaster, if you're a newspaper from whom, and many of your readers, the only source of information every day, basically, is they're picking up the newspaper and they're reading it, it would be crazy to put in your newspaper, hey, here's a claim that some people are saying we don't think it's true. Like, why would you do that? It would, like, and there's an old principle in journalism that you kind of, like, you don't go touching on sort of false information because you wind up spreading the lie by repeating it. But, and I think that is, if you have control over the broadcast pipes, you have a certain kind of responsibility as gatekeeper, just because you de facto are the gatekeeper. If you have control of the printing press, and that's the way people are getting things, you really are the gatekeeper, and these questions of kind of paternalistic responsibility are real. Mm-hmm. If your audience is living on social media, and you're one of a number of things they see, and you're assuming that they are seeing an allegation, like, for instance, about the whistleblower, you don't really have I think it's irresponsible to say, hey, we're gonna not touch this because it's kind of polluted. We're just gonna let you grapple with it alone.
Right.
As opposed to saying, here's the allegation, here's what we know about it and its sourcing, we're not sure if it's true or not, but here's some context. It's obviously not an ideal situation, but that is the situation we all live in now.
Right, right. And because it's online, you can update it multiple times in a day, I guess, right? Too, as the story evolves.
Yeah, but I think that thing of, like, we're just not gonna touch this story until we're totally sure, like, that you sort of wind up leaving the field to the worst and least responsible actors.
Do you feel like maybe it also muddies it too? Like, just to, like, have all of these small developments, like, there is something to be said of just waiting, for an investigative reporter, just waiting and getting all of those strings together and tying all the loose ends and then dropping it.
I mean, I think if you have the luxury of it not being a story everybody's talking about, right? I mean, for sure, that's preferable. It's certainly preferable. But I think often these stories play out in public. I mean, I think it's particularly true often with crime stories that, like, it used to be, I mean, when I was, like, a young reporter, the Indianapolis Star, like, you would get a... There would be a report that somebody had been shot, and you'd have, like, the name of the victim wrong and the name of the guy wrong who shot him, and you'd go to their family's houses and be the wrong house, and, like, a total chaos. But then by the end of the day, you would have, like, kind of figured it out, and the story that was in the next day's newspaper, that was, you know, probably 5 or 6 hours, it's a scramble, would have the facts right and have people's names right. And people would say, oh, these journalists really know what they're doing. And now that sort of 5-hour scramble where you don't know anything and you have everybody's name wrong plays out in public, and everybody says, Jesus, these people are idiots. And the reality is, like, we were always idiots. It's just that, like, it was behind the scenes.
But then why do it? Like, why not wait until you know you've got the name right? Because there are actual consequences, right, to publishing it.
Of course you shouldn't publish it, and particularly when you're talking about individuals' names. But I think that people can now see in real time reporters, like, on Twitter trying to reach out to somebody saying, hey, see us. And I think you can either be transparent about that process, or you can pretend that you have some magical tools that nobody else has, and that journalism is like this kind of, is like, you know, astrophysics, where it would be really hard for you if you didn't have the right kind of education to understand what we're doing, when in fact journalism is a trade and anybody could do it. Experience is useful, and certain kinds of, like, instinct and charm are useful, but, like, it's not, like, no, it's replicable, and I think you just should be transparent about that.
But, so, David Farintool at the Washington Post? I mean, he's really good at this, right? Like, he opens
totally,
up
he's just doing it in public
on Twitter. Your website, though, like, I just want to be clear, like, is there, like, a set of standards that BuzzFeed News
follows? Yeah, we have a
standards
ethics guide that's probably, I think in principle is going to be very close to what the CBC follows, although I think the emphasis in different places will be different. I think we are native to the internet and come from a somewhat different place.
So, like, give me some examples of what's in your standards guide and how it might be different maybe from
Some of the differences are, I mean, I do think that we have a real evidence, again, on, like, showing the receipts in public, showing your work wherever you can, and are more aggressive about that than most.
Because in your articles, there's always tons of, like, links, and you can usually click on the original documents,
we're obsessive about putting the documents up. I would say, conversely, I think we're probably more cautious in some way. We're more open to using somebody's initials rather than their name. Even if maybe the name is actually available in a public document, I think we're pretty sensitive to the reality that people, you know, that you're... not just putting somebody in your newspaper, but you're putting somebody in the Google search forever.
Different time.
I think the questions around sort of, and I think also to the notion of like, okay, this person's tweet is public on Twitter, but really wasn't intended to be public, and the consequences of publishing it with their name attached or embedding it versus screenshotting it and blurring their name. I think we think a lot about that stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear, because you do feel like some of these rules were made for a different time.
Yeah.
Yeah. When, if you just look at like people's old tweets that are being dug up now, I'm sure.
Yeah, when they were, which is in some level, fair, but you.
Yeah.
But there's a level, but yeah, I don't know. You have to be sort of sensitive to the context.
And,
yeah.
I want to talk to you about covering Trump.
Yeah.
And what you've learned. So like we're 1 year out from an American election. We just had like a 6 week election, and I'm exhausted.
I'm
I don't
so jealous.
Have any idea. I'm sick. This is nuts. It felt like long.
I know. I actually didn't realize that it happened. I saw a couple of reports earlier.
You must have
and
seen
I said,
the blackface.
Like, whatever happened to the blackface thing? Like, did he win?
Yeah.
Turned out nobody cared. Yeah.
He won. Yeah. We can talk about that another day. But yeah, he did win.
Crazy.
So how are you covering? How are you approaching it?
It's interesting. Like, the Democratic primary is like a really fun story to cover and a great just reporting thrill to cover. It's just, and I do think that there's been a real change where the traditional way of covering American politics, which I came up doing, is this like horse race politics. You sort of cover it like a sport. People want to know who's winning and who's losing. But I think, but you're sort of an assumption that the stakes aren't that high. And I think like no one thinks that now, and people are like repelled at the notion that it's a game and the stakes aren't high, and people know the stakes are high. And so it's not that they don't care who's going to win and who's going to lose, or they don't care about personalities or about tactics, but they do. It's important that it's in the context of what the stakes are high and this matters. And so I think on the Democratic side, we're trying to cover it that way, trying to sort of look at what people do with power when they have it. We have a newsletter called The Stakes, which you should subscribe to. The president's reelection campaign is the impeachment story.
Yeah.
There's not some campaign that's apart from the presidency, and the impeachment story is fascinating. And I was saying earlier that covering Trump for the first couple of years was so frustrating because in some sense it's like every morning you wake up and he tweets something and there's a day of sort of like reaction, and then you
it's
wake
like
up
the worst the next, thing ever tweeted
and then the next day you wake up and it's like a whole new day and like nothing that happened before is at all relevant and you're just doing the same thing again. And in the experience of it, it's like you're playing tennis against Serena Williams. Like, she serves, and you're, like, diving around the backcourt until she puts it away. And then, like, the next point again, like, it's, like, totally hopeless. Like, you're totally reactive. You're just scrambling around trying to react to stuff. And I do think that that has changed. Like, this impeachment story is different from that. There's a sense that what happened yesterday is relevant today, and that Trump is, and that, I don't know. Like, there are more actors. It's a more interesting story.
Do you feel like because it's building towards something with a consequence?
No, I just think that it's become unpredictable.
Okay. How do you think it's going to turn out?
I think it's unpredictable.
I was trying to preempt that question.
I mean, I think it is I think it's extremely unlikely that he's removed from office, but not impossible.
Yeah. You think it's possible that he could be? Wow. What would need to happen for this? Because obviously he could get impeached by the Democrats, but it then has to go to the Senate, and that's Republican control.
Yeah, public opinion. I mean, it would require public opinion to shift a bit. I think you'd have to be something would have to come out that surprised us.
Yeah.
Something
way more surprising than what we've heard already.
This stuff isn't really surprising. It's just really bad.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm curious on what's on the. There were a couple of different, one of the features of the Ukraine story is that they moved, this call was so sensitive that they stored it in a more secure computer system. The other call they put into that system was the call with the Saudi ruler. And so it's like, I don't know, I think that was also a perfect call.
I just think
there are like more shoes that are.
Do you think they're going to be able to get access to these other shoes?
I do think right now there's this sort of realization in the White House that, Congress is a co-equal branch of government and they have all this legal power. So you're sort of seeing that stuff play out.
Okay. What have you learned about like covering Trump? How have you shifted on how you cover
him? I think
him?
We try to like put as little energy as possible into covering the sort of Twitter outrage of the day. Mm-hmm. Not, by the way, that it's not important. Like, he really is. I mean, those tweets matter. It's not like there's something else happening. And more into covering the policy, particularly, I mean, I think there are parts, there's a big parts of the government where Trump just hasn't really, and this is gradually changing, but like, for a long time, there was a sense that, particularly with foreign policy and defense policy, he just like didn't quite have his hands on the levers, and he would say stuff, and then, you know, there's that British show, Yes, Mr. Minister, like just nothing would happen. That's changed. I mean, Syria was where that really changed.
Right, the U.S.'s decision to pull out of Syria.
Yeah, it was, but he got that done by, he was kept telling his people to do it, and they just wouldn't do it, so he finally tweeted it. There are other parts, and there are still big parts of the U.S. government where people are just sort of doing their jobs and trying to ignore him. I mean, the place that is least true is the Department of Homeland Security, and so we've been really very focused on just covering what is actually happening in the Department of Homeland Security, because they've made these huge changes meant to keep immigrants out.
Right, and do these stories do well for you? Like, this idea that you're not covering the Twitter stuff, but you're covering these...
People want to read about the Twitter stuff. Yeah. We do cover it. We just try not to have... I mean, most of our reporters, most of our, you know, the resource you have in a newsroom is basically people's time. And so, you know, we have particularly these two great reporters, Hamed Al-Aziz and Adolfo Flores, just breaking news every day on ICE.
Like, you were talking before about not trying to cover the horse race. Like, is your sense that people are more interested in, like, the substance of the issues right now because maybe the stakes are so high? Like,
you know, it's complicated. I think it's not, it's again, not that people don't care about and aren't interested in who's winning and who's losing. It's more
I did just ask you who Trump is going to
It's more sort of that
you
want that to be in the context of why it matters. And I mean, you know, and it is true, like, the central fight in the Democratic primary is about healthcare policy. It's not about personality.
Yeah. And you do. You see, I mean, just from where I'm sitting, it does feel like there are really substantial conversations happening.
Yeah, I mean, Trump also ran on substantial, I mean, he ran on immigration restriction, right? Like, that was a policy platform.
Yeah, yeah. And are those stories doing well for you, like the policy heavy?
You know, I think it depends. Like, one of our most read stories was about, you know, Pete Buttigieg's housing policy in South Bend and the sort of racial controversy around it. So,
it's interesting. What do you think it is about? Like, is it the way that the story is approached?
I think people are really interested in understanding, like, what these people would be like as president. Yeah. I think Democrats are in our audience, you know, is younger, basically. And so that's, the notion of thinking through what it would be like to have a president other than Donald Trump is very appealing to people.
Cool. Do you think there's also, you know, I just noticed, too, like, in the podcast that I'm doing, it was interesting to me to see what episodes in the election did well. Because we thought, you know, the episodes that we would put out that were very policy heavy, going over the party platforms, we thought, like, this were just a public service and seven people would listen to them. They actually ended up being, like, our most popular episodes. Do you think, like, do you have a sense that people or younger people, too, are sort of craving?
I mean, I think that people really see these serious differences about the role, like, how people see American government and taxation and these big picture arguments are what's driving the campaign.
Healthcare,
for real.
Yeah. And, like, they want to understand them, or?
Yeah, I think they do, although I think they're not that hard to understand. I mean, I think they're playing out in these very clear, big picture ways.
Who do you think is going to win that? I know, who do you think is going to win the Democratic primary?
I don't want to, I mean, I'm actually right after the 26th election, Catherine Miller and I just, like, put out a, like, no more predictions.
No more predictions.
But I do think, like, where we are in that campaign is that, and this is sort of how these campaigns work because they're so long, is that there's sort of all this sort of who's winning, who's up, who's down, and then, like, the conventional wisdom crystallizes that someone is winning. Like, Elizabeth Warren clearly is the central character in the campaign. Joe Biden, everyone's attacking her, positioning themselves relative to her. She's on every level is sort of winning. And then what happens is everyone's like, oh, let's, like, try this on. Okay, Elizabeth Warren. And it becomes, and there's something a little brittle about the conventional wisdom. And so I think this is the moment when Democrats are kind of thinking through, like, okay, wait, how do we feel about Elizabeth Warren being the nominee? And in particular, do we think that this, you know, that her promise to take away private health care is going to totally screw her in the general, even if we like her.
Right.
Or the fact that she, can she really connect to black voters who she hasn't just particularly spent her career talking to? I mean, so, like, there are the, and so those questions are now central. But and that doesn't, I mean, it sort of, it doesn't mean she's going to win, but it does mean she's the central character right now.
It was interesting to me this week the New York Times did all of that polling in swing states.
Yeah.
And she came in like third to beat Trump, like Biden and Bernie.
And, right, and that really freaked everybody out.
Yeah.
And then, and you know, I mean, it's
these
so
polls
early.
Are always, yeah.
It's so early, but it's also basically usually true that moderate voters or more swing voters are more likely to vote for the moderate. Like, that's not rocket science.
I want to talk to you about the business model of BuzzFeed News. So, you know, we mentioned at the beginning you have about 200 editors and reporters.
Yeah, and it's, that's global, and so some of them
are... So how many bureaus, like...
It's like some of them are reporting in a few of them are reporting like in Portuguese or for our edition there, or mostly for an Australian audience, probably 150 in the sort of US focused operation. But yeah, and that's New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles. And, got a guy in Cleveland.
Cool. And what's your reach like on any given day? Like how many people are you reaching?
You know, I hesitate to quote number. Like I'm sure there's some number in my PR. Like it keeps changing, and it depends on which platform. It used to be
so easy
to say, well, the ComScore number is 200 million a month, and that's what we're doing. But you know, I think the number I like to quote, which is true, is that we're reaching 3/4 of millennials every month.
3/4 of American millennials?
Yeah.
That's a lot. Yeah. Like, do they come directly to BuzzFeed News?
No, most people come to. That's BuzzFeed, and news is probably like
BuzzFeed is.
Sorry, and news is probably like
news?
A quarter of BuzzFeed's traffic and a very overlapping set of people.
Okay. And then it's fair for me to say like a primarily millennial audience.
Yeah. But it's but it's mostly people seeing our stories on social media. It's not mostly people coming to our homepage.
They'll click through on social media. So like, what's the percentage there? Like, if you're looking at
homepage.
I don't know, some pie chart.
We're probably 75% of our audience is coming to an individual story they're seeing somewhere else. And our, you know, our whole DNA is distributed media.
On Facebook or Twitter.
Various other places.
Okay. What, like TikTok?
TikTok's big for us.
I know.
Instagram increasingly,
really
actually.
Aging, yeah.
Instagram's actually big.
Okay. So let's talk about your revenue model. So like, can you just explain to me, you know, how you make your money and where it fits in the larger BuzzFeed ecosystem, right? Like ads.
Yes. And I feel like there's so many things I could say. I feel like, Buzz, it's sort of easier to talk about historically. Like BuzzFeed came up with this very simple business model, which is that we were reinventing sort of native advertising.
Right.
Branded content. And that was all we did. And what that meant was that, in a way, both our news and our entertainment sides were about building an audience and about like figuring out what people liked,
right.
And then we were taking all those learnings, and our advertising side was making ads that in some ways took advantage of those, but we weren't directly monetizing the pages you saw. Like, there weren't any display ads on them. It was sort of a weird thing, actually, in some sense. But also, I think our advertising team really like figured out this new kind of advertising and pioneered it, and was very successful. Continues to be, but as we've like kind of matured as a company, the nature of the media business, when you don't just, you know, work for the government, is is that you
dig at me.
No,
but,
no dig. It's just, you know, it's like a kind of unglamorous business.
Yeah.
Like, if you asked Disney how they make their money, they'll say, well, like, we have 11 different revenue lines and we manage each very carefully.
Yeah.
And so for us, as we've sort of matured, you know, we now have branded content, we have display advertising, we make a lot of money from commerce. Like, I buy all my Christmas presents from, like, 13 presents you should buy a surly teenage girl. But, like, we have great, you know, affiliate stuff.
Okay.
Syndication is increasingly a pretty important, you know, revenue source for news in particular. Facebook, you know, just is now...
Sorry, I don't understand the other one, the buying the presents thing. Sorry, can you do that one again?
Oh, yeah. It's basically, I think, Wirecutter is the other brand that does this a lot, which is that, you know, they rate... Their sort of ratings are based on sort of like, we tested out 17 dryers and this is the best one, and they then get a percentage.
Got it.
And they, you know, they're giving you an honest recommendation and sending you to Amazon, and they then get a percentage when you click on Amazon.
And then will that be on BuzzFeed News, like the main BuzzFeed News page?
No, we're very much part of the BuzzFeed like ecosystem. We're not.
Right. You're like making your.
Like, those posts will be promoted in the news posts,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
but But and then for news, actually, syndication is increasingly a real source of revenue for us, where like places like Facebook are starting to pay publishers for the use of their content, which is a really and like heartening trend, actually. These platforms have always like relied on us to, you know, essentially to provide news
content?
For their customer
yeah.
for free content, and they're starting to pay
and
for it.
And then they take all the ads.
Google is the one that is really resistant to this idea, but hopefully we'll change their minds.
So let's talk about that. Let's park Google for a second, but you've just joined the Facebook News tab, right?
Yeah.
It's you and, is it the Washington Post?
Yeah, the Post, yeah. The Times.
Yeah, and so, like, how does that work? Like, they're paying you a percentage, they're, like, basically licensing your content to put it in the News tab?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a very, very traditional
yeah.
media business model, where you make content and sort of middle people pay to use it. Great.
And so it feels like you're feeling kind of positive about it. It's almost like a partnership with Facebook.
It's really like a very simple business relationship where they're paying you for the use of your content.
Do you feel like, I guess I'm just very skeptical of these partnerships with these big tech companies.
Like, do I feel like it's like bribery
like,
or
yeah,
extortion
or something?
Yeah, or
do you feel like you're trading like dollars for dimes here? You know, like they're just paying you like pennies for...
No, actually. Not. No. I mean, I think in the past that's been the... concern, but like you know, and I don't think the numbers are public, but yeah. I think if you read the reporting about it, like they're not dimes.
Do you also feel like now that you have this relationship where they're paying you, I guess not dimes, like do you feel like you could fairly cover Facebook?
You know, we've all, I mean, I think that's a huge question for everybody, right?
Yeah.
Like, and we've always probably more than anybody else been creatures of this social media ecosystem where the platforms are our central distribution. We've also covered the hell out of them and broken mm-hmm. lots of tough stories mm-hmm. about them. They haven't tried to kind of leverage their business relationship to affect coverage, but I think that's obviously a threat. But, you know, I mean, I think the only thing I would say is that, you know, one strain of the negative coverage of the platforms has been that they're trying to destroy the news business.
Yes.
Which was, like, an accurate story. And to the degree that, like, they are not, in fact, trying to destroy the news business, people will probably stop writing that story. And that's not, I don't think that's transactional. That's just... everybody doing their job. So, but yeah. That is also to say it's sort of a PR thing, right?
Right. That they're like seen to be doing things that are better for. They're trying to like
yeah,
better
they,
their image.
Right.
So
and if they're going to better their image by in fact doing better things, like God bless.
There is this very real push right now, though, to break them up, and
yeah.
you could see that getting like very real and pretty tense.
Oh yeah, I think
quickly.
If Elizabeth Warren's elected,
yeah.
like her, you know, FCC
yeah.
is going to. Look either to split. I mean, the two kind of, and I think you could see the Trump administration doing it too. I mean, I think that there's a lot of overlap between the people and the ideas around, particularly antitrust
yeah.
with Warren and Trump. I mean, the two possibilities are you could imagine splitting, forcing Facebook to split Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, essentially into separate companies to compete with each other. I mean, I think the other, and in some ways more ambitious, like the idea that would, I mean, it's not that, I don't think that would immediately affect all of our lives, actually.
Yeah.
I think the thing that is more, in some ways, more dangerous to Google, I mean, Google is the one where, because they have basically a search business and then an advertising exchange and an advertising business that are kind of like stacked on top of each other. It's not that they're competing with each other. It's that if you're in the online advertising business, you're dealing with Google at every level of the business.
Right.
And I think there's a push to force them to break up in a way that would be much more damaging to the company.
And you mentioned before that they're resistant to like this model of syndicate. Why? Like, what's...
I don't know. Google has this sort of ideological thing where they, you know, I mean, I remember talking to a senior executive there a couple years ago about how important it was in principle that they not ban Alex Jones from the platform. And it was like, are you crazy? Like, I don't even totally understand the principle, but just the reality is you're definitely going to have to do it. Like, you're the number
yeah.
one distributor of this crazy, you know, this guy who's going around, you know, spreading these crazy lies. Like, it's just politically not possible that you can continue to distribute Alex Jones. And they were like, no, we wish we didn't have to, but we're just compelled by our principles. And it's like, and I think they feel that way about, it's just an incredibly important principle that they never pay for news. And I don't really totally understand why they feel that that's such an important principle, but it just seems, I think, probably untenable.
Yeah. Could you see, though, a scenario where, like, things get really heated and these companies are under like real threat, and then they start to leverage these relationships that they have with you? Because so far, like,
I mean, I think that I do think that as they come under political pressure
yeah.
to not be such bad actors in the ecosystem, they will probably stop being such bad actors. Whether that, and I think on a, you know, and particularly on fronts where like the, you know, news is a tiny expense for them,
mm-hmm.
right? Like if they can, if there are sort of adjacent industries that they're screwing up, that they can fix that problem easily, they probably will start to try to. I think that's kind of what Facebook is doing.
Okay, so going back to some of your revenue models, how is that working for you, I guess? Like, how is BuzzFeed?
How's it going?
Yeah. Do you make money? Like, I know BuzzFeed makes money, right? But, like,
yes,
how much money?
It's a little yeah. hard to disentangle. We're not a separate company.
Yeah.
We're not even really, a fully separate website.
Right.
But obviously, digital media is, not the best business in the world these days. I think it's, a little undervalued. I mean, I think right now there's been this swing back toward the New York Times, toward the BBC.
And then the
pendulum in media just sort of notoriously swings back and forth all the time. And I think that, in the long run, are people going to be using social media, consuming stuff on mobile phones? Yes. I think that we feel we're in a really good shape with our audience and that the business is sort of swinging back in our direction after a couple of years of really swinging away. But it's been this very tough 2 or 3 years now for digital media where you've seen almost basically everybody smaller than us and Vox and Vice, get absorbed basically.
Mm-hmm. And you've had layoffs. You lost, I think, 43 journalists.
Tell me about that. We had to lay people off. I mean, it was the worst thing that was my least favorite. I mean, that's the worst thing I've had to do in 8 years here. It sucked. But it wasn't a philosophical decision. It was just we have a lot of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
It's been reported we have $300 million mm-hmm. in revenue, and I think our board.
But BuzzFeed, where does BuzzFeed News fit into that?
There were sort of cuts across the board of the company, and we sort of percentage wise
took
that. But I think there was a sense of that and I think this is basically reasonable that. When we were growing really fast, our investors were like, sure, lose as much money as you want. Mm-hmm. There's a total focus on growth. And when the growth slows and you have a lot of revenue and you're losing money, your investors say, all right, grow up. You've got to be making, the point of this business thing is to bring in more money than you spend.
Are you losing money today?
No.
Okay. So where are you kind of washing your face in the news division?
I'm not familiar with that metaphor.
I'm not even sure.
Did you just make this up?
I feel like I just made this up. Are you just kind of breaking even? Are you
I think. I mean, I think Jonah said that the company's glad to put some money into news.
Yeah.
That it's good. It's good for BuzzFeed's brand. It's good for the world. So my goal is. I think we ought to be. We ought to be basically breaking even. I think that shouldn't be that hard
mm-hmm,
for us
mm-hmm.
next year.
And so next year.
Yeah, but I think the company's on track to be profitable next year. I'm this isn't really my job to say these things,
so I'm
trying to think of what my boss has said and repeat it.
Jonah has said, the advertising community and CMOs respect companies that do news, even if they don't want to advertise on the news content itself.
So it's a little complicated. If you ask, why does every great American media company of the last century, ABC, NBC, CBS, Time, Inc., Hearst, the huge media companies had news divisions that were incredibly important to the 20th century. Also, didn't mostly make their money in the news divisions, but it wasn't incidental that they had news divisions.
Like this prestige thing too.
Yeah, but people write that off. It's just some prestige thing. But actually, prestige is a big part of the media business.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about a few other things you guys have done to try and. I know you've kind of dabbled in memberships.
Yes.
How has that worked?
That's a really good word for it. We played around with a membership program, and
it
basically worked well enough that we want to do more, and we're sort of gearing up to do it for real.
Yeah.
And I think for us, we're never going to put our stuff behind a paywall. We're sort of creatures of the open internet, and so we're trying to think about what is a membership. What we've said so far is basically, hey, if you like what we're doing, support our journalism. Jason Leopold tweeted the other day, hey,
do they get extra stuff?
We send some emails that are basically a little behind the scenes and a little more color, but really the impulse is your support keeps this free for everybody,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that that's something that our readers are really responsive to. That said, we haven't marketed it that heavily. We haven't gone at it that hard. I think we would like to next year and are thinking about how to do that. But again, in the context of what are ways that we can that our audience really wants to engage, that aren't just paying for content, because I think that's in some ways the most obvious thing, but really so counter to our, it's really in our identity that we're free news for the open web, and we want to stay that way.
You also sort of, you dipped into podcasts for a while.
Yes, we had some great podcasts. We kind of lost our way on that, and then have just relaunched. We just launched a podcast that you should all download. It's called Impeachment Today.
It's a great
and
logo.
It's about. It's actually quite funny, but also really a kind of. It's just like the exact amount of information about impeachment that any normal person would want every day.
Every day.
And it's hosted by Hayes Brown. It's just a really great thing.
But it didn't work the first time around when you...
I would say, we had one really hugely successful podcast called Another Round that in some ways, and this is my fault, it was like early days of podcasts in some ways. And one thing that we had not really prepared for was for it to succeed. We hadn't really thought through the business model and things like that and, you know, just very basic stuff around what that would look like. And then we were unable to kind of replicate it, but... We learned a lot.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to.
Yeah, how's podcasting?
It's hard to make a podcast. It's very easy to make a podcast. I think it's much
and the space
harder
has
to make
changed
a podcast
a lot.
That people listen to.
Yeah, it's so competitive now. You have to really put a lot into it.
You're doing this live Twitter show.
I was going to say, in terms of the business, probably the most successful thing we've done is really a lot of production.
Yeah.
We had a show on Netflix last year. We have a live morning show on Twitter called AM to DM.
Yeah. Are these like doing well for you?
Yeah, they are. I mean,
This Twitter show, it's like the Today Show for millennials.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what it is. But as a reporter, actually, like when you're a reporter for the web or for print, you're constantly having people like getting sort of an email like, hey, like Senator Sherrod Brown's in town. Like, do you want to have him on your show? And you're like, we don't really have a show. Like, you can come to the office, but I can't promise we're going to write a story. And so having this broadcast outlet has actually been like such a great muscle for a newsroom, just to like have people through every day who can break news, who are talking, you know, Hassan Minhaj, I think, was on today, but like responding to...
I think he was talking about the Trudeau blackface.
Yeah, that's right. But like, you know, I think like, and so it's just been this great muscle for the newsroom to just have newsmakers coming through all the time.
Yeah, and is that a revenue stream?
Yes, and that's also been a great business for us.
Yeah.
We also have a bunch of shows on Facebook.
Yeah. Okay.
And Snap.
Also. Oh, yeah, Snap.
And I think our sort of like, we're very, I don't know, we live on these platforms and it's a place where they often come to us to sort of experiment with this stuff.
Last question of the night, because I know we need to open this up to questions and maybe we can talk a bit more about all these initiatives afterwards too. 5 years from now, where is BuzzFeed News?
Yeah, 5 years. That's a long time. Are we in the Ivanka administration yet? You know, I don't know. I mean, I think we really feel like we have kind of pretty solid footing as like the most kind of ambitious newsroom of our generation of media. And I think we want to, you know, keep pushing that. I think we want to be breaking big stories.
And what do you think in like 10 years? Maybe let's say 10 years.
I don't know. 10 years.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
It's too much.
Too far.
Yeah. And also, because people thought, like, podcasting was going nowhere. There's so many things that 5 years ago everybody thought, 10 years ago everybody thought was nothing.
Yeah, the internet definitely not going
anywhere.
The CBC
shut down all these radio booths, and now they have to open them back up again.
Yeah.
Okay, Ben Smith, thank you very much.
Thanks.
So those are my questions, but let's definitely open this up to... questions.
There's a mic back there.
Yes.
Hi, okay. Are you familiar with the Young Turks?
Yes.
Okay, so I followed them since I was a teenager, and I think oftentimes, they started kind of similar to BuzzFeed because they started with kind of just fun content, and then they moved into hard news a lot, especially recently, and I think sometimes they're dismissed as an outlet with a political leaning, so you can't take it seriously. But I think one point that they make about journalism in general in the industry that I think is actually kind of interesting is that the mainstream media, a lot of outlets, have a bias towards the status quo or the establishment because, and it's not conscious, but it's because, you know, they're in a bubble, they're rubbing shoulders with people of power, and so oftentimes it affects their coverage. So, for example, if you compare reporting on Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are on substance quite similar, the kind of coverage they get is often different because of one who works within the system and one who doesn't, and they have different relationships with politicians, and hence you could see that kind of affecting coverage, at least in my opinion. So I wanted to get your opinion on whether there is that issue in journalism today or specifically in the States.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, short answer. I think that, yeah, there's kind of a bias toward the status quo. I think, like, people didn't see Trump coming because it was outside what was expected. I think the sort of failure to see how serious Bernie was last time around in particular was that. And I think there's a great piece in Politico today, actually, about how, not just toward the status quo, but also toward a certain kind of, like, of incremental deal-making, relationship-based politics, you know, often written by journalists who, in fact, do know all these people and live in Washington and talk to them off the record and realize that actually off the record they mostly agree on a lot of stuff and are just pandering to, you know, the, like, people out in the land. And so don't see that the real politics is often that, is what Bernie Sanders is saying, not the kind of off-the-record Washington conversation. Yeah, so I do think that's true. I also think, though, that, you know, outsiders use the media as a target, and Trump, obviously, you know, this is his, like, central thing, is to attack the media for misrepresenting him. But outsider Democratic politicians have always done that, too, and Bernie Sanders' attacks on the media, and by the way, the Young Turks' attacks on MSNBC are also about positioning themselves. They're not just, you know, pure observations.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
That was a great question.
Hi there. I'm Madeline White from the Globe and Mail. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about some of your audience. You mentioned that there's overlap between BuzzFeed News and BuzzFeed.com. I'm wondering how extensive that is, and also what you've done to try to grow your audience and balance the kind of challenge between not alienating the already existing audience of BuzzFeed.com and also kind of establishing yourself as a credible news organization.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, these are complicated questions we think about all the time. And I would say it's the fact that most of our audience is coming from social media most of the time means that I think we don't, you know, we're not obsessing about our homepage all day. That said, we did split the sites a year and a half ago, really because I think we felt like people, more than they had earlier, wanted a clear sense of, like, what is this thing? Is this one news? Is this serious? Is this silly? Like, stop blending them so much. That was a response to that. That said, you know, there's a lot of news that is a lot of fun, you know, and I think, like, there's never been a super clear, bright line between the two. And so, you know, often the news stories that get a lot of play on the main BuzzFeed site are either going to be the more fun ones or ones that are just so important that everybody wants to know them. Because most people, you know, care what's happening in the world and also like animals. Like, that's a pretty overlapping
set
of Venn diagrams.
There's, like, an animal Venn diagram here?
Yeah.
Cat videos?
Yeah, the only people, I think it's actually, like, a symptom of sociopathy, not to like animals. We don't obsess about this, actually. But, and I think, you know, we reach so many people, and... But I think, but also the nature of social media, and from the start, this has been true. But really, when we first started, I remember somebody saying to me, like a political source who was just like a total political junkie. I was, sitting with him, and he says, "Oh yeah, he works for BuzzFeed, the new politics site," because he had like no interest in the rest of the stuff, and like didn't even know it existed because his entire media diet was links on Twitter. And I think that's fine. Like, we encourage that as well. Like, you don't have to. We're not trying to, like. There was, you know, Jessica.
Like, he thought there was a special site, but there wasn't. But it's,
like, he didn't know about it. He just was totally unaware of all the rest of the stuff.
Yeah.
And I do think, like, there was a Jessica Seinfeld years ago had a cookbook that was about, like, how to feed your children healthy food, and it was all these recipes about how to, like, bake spinach into brownies, and that is very much not what we do. Like, we're not, like, trying to, like, trick anybody to come and read news.
Thank you.
Hi there. Teresa Ebden from Accenture. I listened a bit to your profitability discussion and how you touched on your P&L, and I was wondering...
Yeah, I probably didn't
like
do that up to Accenture's standards.
Okay.
I was trying to sort of like dance around what we actually say publicly, because it's not really like I'm not the one who releases these numbers.
It's all good. I'm a former journalist, and I wondered, By what margin are you going to be growing your headcount for editorial over the next year? You have a lot of student journalists in here, and I'm sure they're keen to know the answer to that.
That is a great question.
Or not growing your headcount.
I was about to say, that's a really good question. And like, we're basically in the moment as a company, and we're going to be like keeping our headcount flat in order to make sure that we are comfortably profitable next year. Like, that's sort of the nature of, and I suspect if you talk to anybody in digital media right now, that's pretty much where they are. Sorry, everyone.
I might follow up on that. So what advice do you have for all of the young journalists in this audience right now? And then we're going to come straight to you, who are probably wondering how they get into this business and think BuzzFeed News is cool, you know?
I mean, I have always thought that it's like starting at, you don't want to start at a national publication. Like, it's not, you can either go to New York and get coffee for somebody's assistant, or you can go to Halifax and be the City Hall reporter. And it's just like way better to be the City Hall reporter in Halifax. Like, you just learn a lot more. The New York City Hall is exactly the same as Halifax City Hall anyway. You know, it's the same kind of hacks. Upside is a bad word for it, but one of the features of the kind of hollowing out of the news industry nationally in Canada and in the US is that if you can get a job at a regional paper, even it's probably a shitty job in a lot of ways, you really will be covering big stories immediately. Because it used to be that, you know, you had these hundreds of reporters who would cover the big stories, and the junior reporters would get like the boring marginal stories. And now nobody covers the boring marginal stories, there aren't enough reporters, and you're covering murders on your first day. And so I do think, my advice usually is get out of Toronto, get out of New York.
Move.
If you're in a moment in your life when you can move, move. And it's incredibly fun to be a reporter for a medium-sized or smaller place. The sort of poison around at least American political journalism and the fake news stuff just sort of dissipates when you get on to normal stories about normal people.
Hello, Abby Kelly from Ryerson University. Because of your political history covering politics, what is your opinion on the amount of coverage on the presidential political race and how it might eclipse, the upcoming Senate elections?
I mean, American presidential politics is just, always the central American conversation. Mm-hmm. That's just, part of our tradition. That's, where issues of economics and race and policy, just that's where they play out. That just sort of is what it is. I think it's sort of an insane part of American life because you're basically always in the midst of these political campaigns, and these incredibly interesting and accomplished people devote years of their lives to these political campaigns that may often come to nothing, usually come to nothing. I mean, it's kind of a crazy system, but it does also shape the country's decisions about policy, and so, I mean, for better and for worse.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Isabel Strenthal. I'm a student journalist in Toronto. I'm curious specifically about the role that diversity plays in the way that BuzzFeed is covering stories, specifically that you have an LGBT section and that you're covering a lot of stories about underrepresented groups both in Canada and in the US. Do you think that BuzzFeed is covering diversity or talking about diversity in a way that might differ from some of the more traditional news outlets?
Well, here's a question I wish I had asked. That was very good.
Thank you.
I think we had the advantage of starting from scratch in 2012 at a moment. I think the sort of diversity conversation in media, has been, I think, in the year, in the 2000s, all these big newsrooms, places like the New York Times are sort of wrestling, or sort of realizing that they're incredibly homogenous by race and class. And meanwhile, most of what they're doing is laying people off because the business is collapsing. And it's extremely hard to change the ratio of your newsroom at a moment when it's shrinking. And so even if in all good faith you're trying to, it's hard. And I think we had the we had the advantage of starting from scratch in 2012 at a moment when I think our generation of journalists didn't, just felt like these were imperatives. And also that the big American stories were often black stories or Latino stories, the biggest story of 2013 was the marriage story. And so it wasn't, and I think we had an advantage in that we took those stories really seriously and saw them as front page central, it would be crazy not to see Black Lives Matter and marriage equality as the biggest stories in the country. I mean, those are not stories that you go put in your vertical side section. And so, yeah, and I think kind of relatedly, but not exactly for that reason, we've hired a pretty diverse group of reporters and tried to, but I think we'd probably do better.
Thank you so much.
Evening, Mr. Smith. My name is Lexi Epigram, one of the high school journalists represented tonight. You mentioned in passing that ethical standards, especially when it comes to the BuzzFeed, vary somewhat when in relation to more conventional journalistic agencies, specifically through sensitivity and privacy and also citation. As we continue to see an upward trend of social media journalism, how do you expect to see ethical standards respond to that?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, I think that like there's often this discussion of kind of journalistic ethics that suggests that like there's this separate form of ethics for journalists, which I mean really like don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. These are like, you know, the Ten Commandments are fine. But then I think the question of, I think a lot of it is about navigating, not so much changing like journalistic pressures, but changing social and kind of mores. And I think, you know, in particular around privacy. You know, everybody's got a phone, everybody has stuff on their phone that is private in, you know, in varying degrees, and that would be embarrassing if it came out. And I think people don't like the idea that you can go into somebody's phone and print its contents. Like, even if often that stuff is protected by law. And I think we have to be really careful that it's a moment when the law actually allows us to do quite a bit more than I think our audience is comfortable with. And I think that's privacy, to me, is the place most of all where it's important to be pretty careful. I mean, I think people don't often overlook most of the great kind of litigation of the 20th century and the lawsuits against media and the victories of American media in particular were defamation cases and libel cases. And you know, New York Times versus Sullivan was, among other things, about like the right to get things wrong about people if it was in good faith and they were public people. The Gawker case was not a defamation case; it was a privacy case, and I think that's really important to keep in mind. And just to be like, that when you're doing these stories, you're like just the fact that there's a difference between just exposing secrets and what are important secrets, and I think that's a really important distinction.
Yeah, and right, the Gawker case is essentially, for people in the room, when Hulk Hogan essentially sued Gawker into non-existence.
Yeah, and
with the help of Peter Thiel.
With the help of Peter Thiel. It was a real conspiracy.
Because they published a sex tape, right?
Right, and it was a conspiracy to destroy Gawker because they had done real journalism about powerful people. But the instrument of the conspiracy was this, you know, they'd published, like, you know, what was called then, like, a sex tape, or like this intimate tape of him that, like, I think a lot of people on the jury probably saw that and were like, Jesus.
Yeah,
like,
this is not in the public address.
Like, and also, by the way, they probably identify with Hulk Hogan in that situation.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Natalie. I come from North Toronto, and our newspaper is Graffiti. And, well, as technology and social media evolves and generations rely more and more in technology, do you believe that physical newspapers will stop existing, or will there be a decline in physical newspapers?
I mean, I think physical newspapers are pretty well on their way to stopping existing. I mean, and anybody who works at a newspaper will tell you that. I mean, I think news organizations and a lot of Canadian and U.S. news organizations are, you know, working really hard to figure out how you take journalism, which people really do want, and move it onto other platforms, onto your phone primarily. I mean, I love print. I read books and, you know, print is fun and there's, like, and can be really lovely and there's a sort of, like, I think that you'll see these sort of bespoke, you know, really expensive print projects that where it's more like this kind of object that you have, but it's not like a daily newspaper where the ink comes off in your hands and you throw it away at the end of the day. Vinyl records are back, yeah, but it's got to be like real, yeah. So there's a, there are like these, there's sort of a new generation of these very beautiful little magazines that are kind of successful, but it's hard to see. I mean, it's just not the best way to get your news, right? That, like, somebody prints it out at 4 in the morning and then, like, chops down a bunch of trees and prints it out at 4 in the morning on the pulped remains of the trees and then hires a bunch of drivers to go around this. I mean, it's kind of a crazy way to get information.
Okay, thank you.
Evening. My name is Jackson Mackis, and I'm one of the editors at Northern Secondary School's Epigram. Thanks again, Mr. Smith, for sitting down with us, and I'd like to know, for journalists directly reporting it and also for editors overseeing it, what are the general guidelines for handling information that would fall under sensitive, i.e. things that you might not publish, things that will definitely cause a stir, things that people don't want the public to know, and are all the rules in general, uniform for media.
I mean, all those categories of things are basically like all the things you want to publish, right? Like, I mean, the main rule is you publish them.
Yeah.
And thanks for the question. All the students, I wish the adults had asked questions as good as all the student questions. But your questions were almost as good as the high school kids' questions. There are different categories. I would say most of all, like when you have a piece of information that, A, you know is true and like makes you a little nervous and like you think might cause trouble, like definitely publish it. Like that is the thing to publish. The one thing I would say is that we think a lot about protecting our sources, and that means being really careful with documents. In particular, we love to publish the documents, but if there's any suggestion that publishing the document is going to unmask the source, we will retype the document. I think you have to be really, really careful about making sure that you're not endangering the source of a document, if that's an issue.
Yeah, of course. Thanks again.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I work at BlogTO. It's a hyper-local blog based in Toronto.
A very good blog, I would say.
Thank you.
You guys are great.
With a reach of over 175 million last year and a digital strategy that relies very heavily on SEO through Google and through distribution through social media platforms. I wanted to ask you what BuzzFeed News does to contend with shifts in the tech industry when it comes to algorithms and any kind of social media changes.
This is another good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. I would say that we try and, two things. One is that, we do occupy this sort of privileged position where we are in dialogue with all those companies in a way that a local publisher can't be, and tend to like know what's coming and have an open line to Facebook and to Google, and to which is valuable, right? I think we also try really hard not to game the system too much. Like if you're doing something that works really, really well and you're getting tons, like the classic example is Curiosity Gap headlines. Like you won't believe what this person, and we never did those because ultimately that's basically spam. And it worked because it was like kind of a trick on Facebook. But if you're thinking of it from Facebook's perspective, it's spam, and eventually they're gonna kill it, right? And so we try to think about it more from the perspective of like what would a user of Facebook want rather than what is the trick this week that will game Facebook. And so I think we've sort of weathered some of these changes better than most because we really are trying to think about what would a human being want to share, not what tricks the algorithm this week. Also, I do think like local, I think local online news business is like unbelievably hard right now, but also like the coolest thing and like so satisfying and kind of fun actually. And I've, used to write a hyperlocal blog on the side and very involved in the Brooklyn site and this New York site, and generally like God bless, that's the best stuff.
For sure, thank you so much.
Okay, I'm gonna cap it. Oh, okay, let's cap it after these two. And then, okay, great. I will say I'm so jazzed to see so many young women stand up and ask questions today. It's fantastic.
Hi, I'm Juliet Hardy.
No pressure.
No pressure. This will be great. Yeah.
I'm from Northern, and I'm one of the editors at the Epigram. And so when you were mentioning CNN, you said they had these shocking documents, and they didn't want to publish them. So I was wondering where you draw the line of what you publish, and do you ever feel like you need to incorporate a sense of civic uplift?
Civic uplift?
Yes, like everything's so depressing, and do you feel like you have to put a positive spin to not like terrify the population?
I mean, things are pretty terrifying.
That's where those that's where those cat videos come in handy.
You're right. I do think people. I think one of the things that often travels well on social media and that we publish are like just like inspiring, lovely stories about people doing nice things, and we certainly do our share of those. I don't want to like claim that we do that out of a sense of responsibility, however. Like people love those stories, that's why we publish them. I think we do think a lot about, I think there's a temptation in all forms of media toward sort of exploitation and toward publishing kind of gruesome or pictures or, I don't know, often in a way, like the story that really I found disturbing this week, we had this great story about how local police departments are like turning people who are like arrested for heroin possession into memes and making fun and sort of to humiliate them. Yeah. And I do think news organizations often play a role in this cycle of like humiliating petty criminals like sex workers and drug addicts in particular in a way that when you step back is just really awful and inappropriate. And I think a lot of news organizations have kind of stepped back from using mugshots. But also, I do think that it's a good story, actually, to like go to the police department and be like, what are you doing? Like, this woman served her time. And like, why is this a valuable service? You know, why is this part of your public policing duties to humiliate her on your Facebook page? And actually, maybe they're just doing it because it's a good way to generate Facebook growth. Like, it's viral. And they're like making viral content for because like the social media manager for the police department wants to like grow the number of likes to the page. And they have like this great viral content, which is this woman's tragedy, you know? And I think like that's a place in particular that, I don't know, that story this week made me think about a lot.
Yeah, I read that too. That was a great story. If people haven't read it yet, it's great.
Thank you very much.
Last question.
Hi, I'm Kaylee. I actually go to Humber for radio, so I'm not in journalism exactly. So I don't actually know if you'll know the answer to this, but you mentioned that the amount of reporters you have on staff slash other, I guess, news media have on staff is shrinking, so things are becoming a lot smaller and smaller. Would you say the same is happening in radio, and maybe specifically like radio journalism?
I mean, I think you may know better than I do, Jamie. I wouldn't say, I think actually like we're kind of like holding even, and I think the industry right now is contracting. There's this huge podcast boom right now. I think it's a good time to be working in audio. And you know, everybody is scrambling for great producers. And I think in particular what we found, you know, there's talented producers are always in demand in general, but there partly because the industry is pretty new, there are not a lot of producers who have the kind of journalistic chops to who have experience working on really complex investigations, just because there haven't been that many done. I mean, there's some, and there's some great ones. I mean, Thunder Bay from Canada Land is so great. And I think, like, but when we have, and just because I'm thinking this is on my mind now, like a couple of long-term investigations that we're working on, we're talking to the relatively small number of production companies that have experience working on those, and there is, like, clearly, like, there's just not an infinite number of producers who have worked on complex investigations. I'm not sure that's like a really good career advice or anything, but it is. It does seem like there's.
Yeah.
I don't know. You may know more. What do you think?
I mean, I don't. I kind of think, unfortunately, at this stage, like you got to do it all. If you can't, you know, you got to. We all have to stop thinking about radio journalism and TV broadcast, and it's just all the same. So you know, you want to get those hard skills in all of these areas, and then also try to get these journalistic chops because, like, this is stuff that will take you very far, right? Like, you know, experience on any investigation in any medium, you can just roll that into a podcast. Like, I know print reporters that are moving to podcasts quite seamlessly, like, in terms of investigative, like, moving to, like, more investigative work.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they also need people around them who are have experience in audio, but
yeah, it's important to be excited about the stories and then figure out what medium you're best at or most excited about.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I heard confusing, complicated, chaotic, which seems to me the best of times for journalism. These are indeed interesting times. I would like to thank Jamie and Ben, and please join me in a round of applause for this really great conversation. Before we disband for a drink and some conversation, I'd like to tell you about our upcoming events. Do we have our slides? Okay. I'm really pleased to tell you that on December 3rd, the Canadian Journalism Foundation will host Ronan Farrow, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of Catch and Kill, in conversation with the Globe and Mail's award-winning investigative reporter and author of a new book, Had It Coming. So this is a great event. Tickets are just starting to go on sale. Please watch for it, and we'd love to see you there. And high school journalists, we'd love to see you there too. In February 6, we welcome Kara Swisher in conversation with Kevin Newman. Kara is the co-founder of Recode and host of a podcast, Decode, yes, and also writes a regular column in the New York Times. If you haven't read it, you should. You should start following her. Really interesting. So that's what we have coming up, and we'd be happy to see you at our events. Thank you again. The bar is open.